I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, so we saved you some time to get right to the good stuff. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Guantanamo. It's a name that has been in and out of the headlines so many times over the past two decades. This year, the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, hits its 20th year. It's a milestone many people hoped it would never reach. The prison was created to detain people suspected of terrorist activities after the September 11th attacks. Since 2002, more than 700 men and boys have been held there, nearly all without being officially charged with a crime. Today, fewer than 40 detainees are at Gitmo. It's unclear what their future holds. Today on Vermont Edition, we're speaking to two Vermonters who were part of a years-long effort to free one Guantanamo detainee. They are also intimately familiar with the prison itself. First, we have David Slay, an attorney in St. Johnsbury. David, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me here.
David worked closely with another lawyer, Bob Gensberg, who passed away 4 years ago on one specific case. Bob's widow, Leslie Gensberg, joins us now. She also got to know the detainee, Abdul Zahir, by working closely with her late husband on Zahir's case and through letters that she wrote to Zahir. Welcome, Leslie.
Thank you.
David Slay, could you start us off by giving us a bit more of an overview than what I just provided of what Guantanamo is exactly? How is it different from a regular prison?
Well, I suppose it differs mostly in its design, which was to evade United States constitutional protections and to evade compliance by the United States with the pertinent Geneva Conventions as they regulate the treatment of prisoners seized in conflict. I would think most prisons' goal is to try to consistently apply punishment, deterrence, disability for people who had been found to have broken the law. Gitmo's primary purpose was to evade the application of the law.
And is that part of the reason why it's in Cuba?
That's the entire reason it was in Cuba. So in 2002, after the terrorist attacks, the Bush administration sought a way to gather and detain people that they newly minted as enemy combatants in a way that would avoid scrutiny and avoid review. The notion was that the United States naval base down at Guantanamo Bay was not on territory that was adequately controlled by the United States and thus would be outside the application of United States constitutional law. And so that was the entire design.
Now, some of the words that we use in conversations around Guantanamo are words you really only hear applied to this specific prison and situation. Words like detainee, enemy combatant. Can you go a bit deeper into those words? Why do we use those phrases instead of prisoner, for example?
Well, I think if you ask Leslie, she's better at this than me because she uses, I think, the more appropriate term, prisoner. Mm-hmm. I spent well over 10 years advocating for detainees, as they were known in the pleadings that we all filed, Abdul Zahir and two others. So I probably slip into the lingo of litigation, but prisoner is probably the better notion. Mm-hmm. Enemy combatant was a new term that was designed to classify people who were seized in the war on terror differently than prisoners that were seized in any other conflict. And the reason for that is that the Geneva Conventions that would regulate how prisoners were to be treated and what rights they would be afforded wouldn't apply to this new category of so-called enemy combatants. So there were two lawyers in the White House who literally drew up memos, the most notorious being the famous torture memo, recommending to the Bush administration this novel legal construct to justify the mistreatment and detention without any due process that was planned for the folks at Guantanamo.
Now, Leslie Ginsburg, could you tell us a bit about what it was like to first hear about the prison opening? Do you remember that time?
Well, anybody who was an adult by that time would have a hard time not thinking about it. It was horrifying. My husband, Bob, had, as a lawyer, as a person, devoted his life to the American system of the rule of law. I can't tell you how deep in his bones that was. He carried a copy of the Bill of Rights around in his wallet. And when all this started, it was just crushing to him, not just as a lawyer, but as an American. And I shared that certainly with him.
What exactly felt crushing? Can you tell us a bit more?
Well, everything that Dave has just talked about, the fact that this was a deliberate attempt to deliberate, and I have to say all this time, successful attempt to avoid the Constitution of the United States and justice.
Now, your late husband, Bob, worked very closely with David Slay on the case of one prisoner there. How did Bob and you first get involved in Guantanamo?
We were at a gathering where this was probably a couple of years after Guantanamo had been going on. And a friend there, a casual friend, turned out to be a board member of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. And they were the organization that was assigning volunteer lawyers to detainees. I'm not quite sure how that happened, but that's how it was. And this man, Franklin Siegel, asked Bob if he'd be willing to represent one of the detainees, and Bob immediately said yes. And when he told me that he was going to do that, I just felt at last, we had been feeling so helpless. At last, I did nothing, but at last somebody I knew could do something or try to do something about what was going on.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a sentiment that many of us can empathize with seeing something that we perceive as an injustice with the world and not quite knowing how to fix it or to address it ourselves. David, how did you first get involved?
Well, just to fill in a little bit,
sure.
The Center for Constitutional Rights was really the first organization to file habeas petitions on behalf of prisoners at Guantanamo, arguing that they had some ability to challenge the validity of their detention under a statute, United States statute. That case bounced around through the various district and circuit courts until somewhere in the summer of 2004, when the court held that the habeas corpus statute would allow detentioners to challenge the validity of their detention. So for 2 years, the facility opened, I believe, on January 6, 2002. So for 2 years, there was absolutely no access to lawyers for any prisoners. That was the administration's design that was what was going on. So in 2004, when the Center for Constitutional Rights finally prevailed, suddenly they had 600 people who needed lawyers. And they went on a recruiting mission. I had just won a prison malpractice case in the Seventh Circuit out in Chicago. And that made some news amongst the prison law set. And the constitutional rights folks just called me as a cold call and said, look, you seem to know something about jails and something about the Constitution. Would you be willing to represent some Guantanamo prisoners? And I was, of course, absolutely delighted to be able to do that.
Well, I imagine it must have come with a bit of thought. I mean, I'm sure you're a very busy person. You're representing somebody here, you know, of course, without pay, in what could be a years and years long legal process. Did you have any such hesitations?
Absolutely not. It's the most important work I think I've ever done in the 39 years that I've been practicing.
Wow, that's
significant. I mean, it struck me as just inconceivable that the United States government would endeavor with such cold calculation to create a system that would deny people basic human rights. It seemed completely at odds with the whole experiment that is the United States. And I was happy to join to try to rectify that.
Let's go now to Deb in Burlington. Deb, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I want to speak really forcefully about the need to close Guantanamo. And I would ask your guests to please comment on the detention of so many people who were captured by Afghan warlords and turned over because of the bounty that our country offered, so that they rounded up random people, honestly, and turned them over and said they were terrorists so they could get, I think it was $10,000. And I connected with one of those who was released after 14 years. People may have heard of him, Mansour Adaifi. He's written a book called Don't Forget Us Here, and he's kind of made a name for himself. But specifically, I don't think people know that so many people were just turned over falsely so that this bounty reward could be collected.
Well, thank you for the call, Deb. And David, would you be able to speak to that point that Deb was making?
Yeah, directly. I mean, one of the three prisoners I represented was a fellow by the name of Condon Kadar. The CIA was flying over Logar province, dropping leaflets, offering bounties to people to turn in suspected Taliban or terrorist members. And Condon was turned in for a bounty with the allegation that he had worked with the Taliban. In some weird sense, I guess he did. He had gone to France as a young man and got a degree in pharmacy. When he returned, he was the only person in his village who had any modicum of medical training. And as such, he was designated the representative of the Minister of Health of the Afghan government before the Russian invasion. When the Russian-sponsored government took over, he continued as the designated representative of the Minister of Health for purposes like coordinating inoculations in his village or prescription drugs, that sort of thing. When the Russians left and there was an interim Afghanistan government, he remained the designated Minister of Health representative in his village. And when the Taliban took over, he remained the designated representative of the Minister of Health. That landed him in Guantanamo for 7 years.
Mm-hmm. I also want to note that the caller, Deb, just mentioned a former prisoner, Mansour Adaifi. He will be attending by Zoom an event on Sunday at 7 p.m. for an art show at St. Johnsbury that is focused on the art of Guantanamo detainees. And we're going to talk about that a bit more later in the hour. David and Leslie, I know you both have been involved in that exhibit as well. But first, I'd love to dive into Abdulazahir's story a bit here. Leslie, let's start with you. I know you were in correspondence with him a bit. What can you tell us about his story?
Well, I know that Bob was assigned to him, and he made many trips to Guantanamo and came to know this man pretty well. He was, a real linguist. He was a translator. He already spoke, I think, 4 languages and learned English, was learning English pretty quickly, mainly from interactions with the guards, as I remember. Mm-hmm. He was a very intelligent man. He had left behind his wife or wives and 3 sons. His wife was pregnant and the 4th son was born. He did not get to see him until he was released 14 years later. And he was a very warm and outgoing person.
And you two wrote letters a couple times to each other. Is that right?
That's the plural is a bit much. Well into this, actually, in 2016, when it had just gotten on the edge, Obama had come in, things had relaxed somewhat, and Bob and Dave were trying like mad to get him out of there, especially before the terrible change of administrations. And I asked Bob at some point, would it be okay? Do you think they would allow me to give you a letter to him? And he said, write it and I will see. And if they let him have it, fine. And they did. And what I wanted to say to him, what I did say to him was just how ashamed I was of my country and what it had done to him and the others. And I just expressed I wanted him to know that not everybody in America was like that.
And he wrote you back, is that right? What did he say?
He wrote me back. I'll read it to you. This is November 2016. He said, best cordial greetings from the depth of my heart. I wish this letter finds you well, in good health, and with a life full of happiness and prosperity. I received your kind letter. I have no doubt that the U.S. is full of people, especially women, who carry a lovable and merciful heart like yours. I am also certain that the person or the people who do injustice to others can represent the overwhelming majority who carry good hearts. They are like a rose tree, which carries a number of thorns, but also carries hundreds of roses that attract people by their beauty and pleasant fragrance. No one would dislike the rose tree because of these thorns. This is how I wanted to reply to your kind letter. Thank you very much again from the depth of my heart for these feelings and emotions. Abdul Zahir.
That was a letter that Leslie Ginsburg received from the Guantanamo detainee Abdul Zahir. David, as Leslie mentioned, you and Bob traveled to Guantanamo many times to work on this case. Could you tell us a bit about what those journeys were like for you?
Well, initially, there was a fair amount of hostility from the government and the prison authorities to defense lawyers coming to see their clients. And while we certainly didn't get paid for any of this, none of our expenses were covered either. And in the early days, Bob and I would fly to Fort Lauderdale, get on a CIA Airlines airplane, had no bathroom, and fly 3.5 hours at low altitude to the prison. We were housed at the old bachelor's quarter on the, I guess that would be the leeward side of the bay, in quite stark conditions. Bob and I avoided having to sleep in tents. That's where they often put journalists who were even on a lower rung of appreciation than defense lawyers. But on occasion, we had to stay in these couscous that were built out on an abandoned tarmac. And in the early days, we weren't allowed to move about the base at all without a military escort. And about the time of the Obama administration taking over, the military commission that was in charge of trying to set up some kind of, allegedly in charge, and trying to set up some kind of trials for these prisoners created a defense counsel division. And after that, we were quartered in somewhat more hospitable facilities, and we started to be able to fly from Joint Base Andrews in DC on military flights, which is like, I think Delta ran them. But for the first 4 or 5 years, it was very, very stark and uncomfortable conditions. That changed somewhat as time went on.
And how did you go about earning Abdullah Zahir's trust?
Well, that wasn't a linear process at all. I mean, I think at first he was happy to see that there was somebody that at least expressed that they were working on his behalf. But this whole process went on for Bob and I for a decade. Abdul Zahir arrived in Guantanamo in October of 2002. He was finally approved for discharge in July of 2016, and he wasn't released until January 17th, 2017. So during that period of time, there were initially charges were brought before the military commission. The Supreme Court held that those commissions weren't adequate. And thereafter, what Bob and I really tried to do, this is the first time I've ever done this as a defense lawyer, we were begging the government to charge Abdul with a crime so we could have a trial, because we were convinced that they had the wrong guy. And so as these peaks and troughs of hope and disappointment went on and on for years, I think Abdul Zahir's confidence in us and his willingness to talk to us ebbed and flow. At one point, Bob and I went down to the island, and he initially refused to meet with us. We'd go every single day. We had basically 4 days down there, and he finally relented and spoke with us, and things started to progress again to some degree in terms of his faith in us. But to be honest, it would be hard to have faith with a lawyer who's been representing you for 8 or 9 years and had really essentially nothing to show for it except for a lot of effort.
Mm. And Leslie, when Bob would come back from these trips to Guantanamo with David, did he come back feeling defeated, energized, angry? What were some of the emotions he expressed to you upon his returns?
Well, he certainly wasn't energized. Disheartened. Just the whole thing was just so depressing. Dave and Bob and the other lawyers somehow kept trying to play by the rules, the rule of law. Mm-hmm. And the government was just laughing up their sleeves at them. I do want to credit to one good side of the government. I assume all the detainees, but Abdul Zahir was assigned a military lawyer for his defense. And when Bob heard that, his heart sank. He thought, oh, this is going to be a big laugh. But it turned out not to be. And Sterling Thomas was the lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, a lawyer who was assigned to help with representing Abdul Zahir, and both Dave and Bob just came to have tremendous respect and admiration for this man. He threw himself into it just like any good defense lawyer would.
Let's go now to Steve in Rutland. Steve, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I think it should be closed. And I just wanted to point out that not a lot of attention is given to looking at the origins of the war there and how, you know, like the events of 9/11. I think we should take another look at how the buildings fell down. There are groups looking into this and trying to get congressional attention and other, you know, important leaders to instigate that. Just a review and a refresh of what we got ourselves into kind of hastily. So thank you for the show.
Thank you, Steve, for that call. Now, Steve just said, you know, that we should look at the origins of the creation of this prison. And David, I'd love to hear more from you on this with how it pertains to the legal aspect of what these prisoners were facing. You know, the war in Afghanistan is technically over. The U.S. exited Afghanistan late summer, early fall last year. These prisoners at Guantanamo were deemed enemy combatants, but the war on terror is in many ways a chapter closed. How did that affect the legal status of these men?
Well, that was one of the sort of creative aspects of the Bush administration policy that led to the establishment of Guantanamo, so that the notion was that the war against terror wasn't like World War II, where you had defined sides wearing uniforms and that there was a surrender and Germany was defeated and the war was over. The Bush administration's view on the war on terror is that it was a global and timeless, so that these men who they deemed to be enemy combatants and held extraterritorially could and would be detained indefinitely without any ability to challenge the validity of their detention. So if you look at the people who are down there now, roughly 40, there are, I can't remember the exact number, but something like 24 who have been charged with offenses directly related to 9/11 and the attack on the Navy destroyer. The name of the boat is escaping me now. But those proceedings have just been dragging on. In fact, Sterling Thomas, who Leslie talked about, is actively representing somebody in those trials. The rest, the government, and that's the Bush administration, the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and the Biden administration, have been designated to be detained essentially forever, with the acknowledgement that the government doesn't have enough proof that they could present to a fact finder to prove that they committed any particular crime justifying their detention. And nevertheless, the declaration that in the government's opinion, those people are simply too dangerous to be released. So that there'll be some people who will be detained forever without the ability to challenge their detention. Now, of the, I think, over 850 people who have gone through Guantanamo, that probably cooks down to 12, 15, 20 people. But nevertheless, that seems to be emblematic of you know, the whole disaster that Guantanamo was and is.
Now, I'd love to return to Abdul Zahir's story here. He finally got a hearing in 2016. Leslie, I know your husband was not able to attend. Is that right? What do you remember from that time?
I think he probably was ill at that time and couldn't be there in person. I have a letter here that Abdul Zahir wrote after he had been okayed for release. This was in September 2016. And he didn't write it to Bob, but I think it's really tremendously affecting. He said, "In the name of God, most gracious and most merciful, to President Obama and all his ministers, to any person who has heart and any person who has human feeling. I have been in Guantanamo for 14 years. I am that prisoner who was arrested instead of another person. I am already cleared for release. I simply want my freedom as soon as possible. Please send me back to my country or any other country. If not, then send my wishes to my family, then send me to the grave. Guantanamo, enough is enough. Enough to languishing in Guantanamo. Enough to the injustice.
Thank you.
What can you say to something like that? And Dave will tell you about the nail biting right up until he actually got on that plane, and he was sent to Oman, not back to Afghanistan. Dave?
So just to recap, the U.S. military forces entered Zahir's family home and arrested him on July the 11th, 2002. They seized from the home three pressure cookers. Two had a white powdery type ingredients. One had something that looked more like gel. Within 48 hours of the seizure of the pressure cookers that were thought to contain bomb making supplies, they identified the contents as salt, sugar, and petroleum jelly. From July 11, 2002 until October 28, 2002, Zahir was either at Bagram Air Force Base or a dark site in Central Europe where he was tortured. He was brought to Guantanamo, tortured some more. When we finally, after years of begging, had an opportunity to present some evidence in June of 2016, the review board found that Zahir was subject to release, and they confessed that his detention likely sprung from misidentification. Mm. So that was in July, I think July 11th, he was approved for release in 2016. He languished in Guantanamo from July 2016 until January 17th, 2017, 4 days before Trump was to be inaugurated. Trump had made it clear that no one was going to leave Guantanamo once he became president. And I know that all of us were literally, sweating bullets that Zahir would go wheels up sometime before the inauguration. And in fact, we weren't sure where he was when the president was inaugurated. And I feared that the president would tell the Air Force to turn around and bring him back. Mm. And it wasn't until sometime after the inauguration that it was confirmed to us that Zahir had landed in Oman. Mm.
It sounds like something out of a thriller movie, frankly, but it was real people's lives. It must have been such an incredible sense of relief for you to hear that he had landed in Oman. What have you heard from him since?
I haven't heard anything. And so Leslie actually probably knows more about this than I do. But Zahir was transferred on the 17th of January, 2017 with nine other detainees. Oman agreed to accept them. But my understanding is that they were to be housed together with relatively limited liberty, phased in with technology, given cell phones and whatnot, but with fairly serious restrictions on how they could move around, who they could communicate with. I know we did get one wonderful picture of Zahir with his sons waiting in the ocean somewhere on the Oman coast. But other than that, I don't know that I certainly haven't heard anything from him.
Mm. And Leslie, what have you heard?
Well, we do know that his family from Afghanistan was brought to join him in Oman. I have here an email that he sent to Bob. Bob had given him a laptop to take with him. And he sent Bob an email on January 27th. And he said, I am in learning camp now. And here we are not allowed to connect with you or with other person. Please, I will connect with you after 3 months and pray to God for your best health. Thanks, your sincere friend, Abdul Zahir. That's the last anyone has heard of him. We have since found out that he, the Omani government, which apparently is a pretty decent bunch, that they do not allow any of these former prisoners from Guantanamo to connect with the outside world.
I want to go straight back to the phone lines. We have a call from David in Wilmington. David, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't understand why you're so concerned about these people who committed horrific crimes against the United States. I'm sure they're not there by accident. I'm sure they had some involvement in it, and I just cannot understand why you're so worried about freeing them or whatever it is you're trying to do.
Well, thank you for the call, Dave. And I do want to clarify that Abdullah Zahir, the person at the center of this story, was in fact there by accident. David Slay, can you go into that in a bit more detail? Do you have any sense of how many prisoners were actually charged with crimes and convicted of anything?
Well, very few people have been charged with crimes and convicted of anything. That might be because very few people were afforded a right to have a trial. But the vast majority of the people that were imprisoned there have been okayed for release after the United States governed them not to be a threat to the United States or anybody else. One of the fundamental aspects of our system of justice is that you cannot deprive somebody of their liberty without proof that that deprivation is legally based. That's really what it means to be an American. And so having concerns for people who are imprisoned and who are denied a trial is really, I think, a fundamental value in and of itself. Secondly, I and certainly Bob have enormous faith in the United States system of criminal justice. Had the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks and other terrorist actions been tried publicly in United States criminal courts so the world could see the evidence and the juries could come to their verdicts, the United States would have lived up to its reputation as the shining city on the hill rather than a bunch of cowards.
Let's go now to one more phone call. We have Jim in New Haven with us. Jim, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Great. Okay. So my question, I'm very appreciative of all the comments that have been made so far about human rights and potential human rights violations that have taken place, but I haven't heard any comments about the actual cost of Guantanamo Bay. So I was just doing a bit of quick research, and New York Times had published an article saying that it costs U.S. taxpayers about $13 million per prisoner at Guantanamo Bay, which compares to about $33,000 $200 plus $1,000 for the average.
So you cut out there, Jim, but I did hear you, and we were able to quickly confirm that the New York Times did say that the cost per prisoner at Guantanamo is about $13 million per year. Thank you for highlighting that point. I want to turn briefly here to an exhibit that's opening up in St. Johnsbury at Catamount Arts that's called Ode to the Sea, Art from Guantanamo. And it includes art from Abdullah Zahir and other detainees at Guantanamo. Recently, the journalist Erica Heilman interviewed the curator of that exhibit, Aaron Thomas. And you can find the full interview on vermontpublic.org. But I do want to play a quick clip from the interview here. Let's take a listen.
When you think about someone who hasn't seen nature, whose view is all blocked by cages that are tarped off so he can't even see what's outside the cage for more than a decade, what does that person choose to paint to bring a little beauty into his life? And this is what we get to see in the show. The show is divided into a few sections, things that illustrate the conditions of making art there. There are lots of rules. They could only use soft things, materials that they couldn't possibly harm anyone else with. One of the sections of the show is pieces that deal with the sea, because I saw that again and again in works from many different artists at Guantanamo. And finally, when I was able to talk to former detainees or send questions to current detainees through their lawyers, I asked, why the sea? And they said that's because they're surrounded by the sea. They can smell it, they can hear it, but they can't look at it. The views are blocked. And to them, imagining the sea is to imagine freedom, imagine sailing away.
Now, Leslie Ginsberg, you have a painting from Abdullah Zahir that will be in this art exhibit. Is that right? Can you tell us about it?
Yes, and it's exactly what Aaron is talking about. Abdul Zahir gave this painting to Bob, and it's a seascape, the ocean. In the foreground, there's a cactus, and he explained that that represents Guantanamo. And then you
I'm
see
sorry, I'm sorry, Leslie, did you say a cat?
Cactus.
Cactus. Okay, you cut out there. Okay, thank
sorry.
You.
Then in the foreground, there's a rowboat. And he explained that's him being rowed out to the battleship. And the battleship in the middle of the picture has an American flag flying on it. And he said that represents the United States government, where he will finally get his hearing and be released. And then the best part is a sailboat. And he said in that sailboat, it's Captain Bob and Captain Dave sailing him home to Afghanistan.
Oh, wow. David, what does it feel like to hear that description of the painting?
Well, I've seen the painting, of course, and many years after Zahir left Guantanamo, Sterling Thomas, the military lawyer, was delivered a box of items that Zahir left behind at Guantanamo. And there was a note to me about the painting. And he said that he didn't want to paint two because it wouldn't be original, but that his thoughts were with me. And of course, whatever little Bob and I were able to accomplish for him, knowing that he's out of that place is a huge, huge satisfaction.
And yes, go ahead, Leslie.
I could add a little bit to that. I have another letter
please.
That he wrote to Bob in December of 2016, and I'll just read one paragraph of it. I don't know if Dave knows how to blush. Fellow detainees are very impressed with the work that you and Mr. David are doing in my case. Also, Lieutenant Colonel Thomas has been a great helper and believer in me. They announced, they meaning the other prisoners, they announced you all to be from the best legal teams that are working on Guantanamo cases. I am really very grateful to you all and proud of you all as well.
That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that with us, Leslie. We are just about out of time, but David, any last thoughts from you on the prison? Do you think that there is a chance that we might see it closed anytime soon?
I would hope so. I suspect the financial aspect of it will win out, that it's just too expensive to keep 40 people like that. And just my last thought, you know, I was walking upstairs to Bob's office. His office was directly above mine. I could drill through my ceiling and get there. And we were coming down, he was coming down the stairs, I was going up, and I was just talking about this Guantanamo stuff. And he said, I've got a prisoner there too. And there were the two of us working independently at the time with two different prisoners had no idea that each was involved. And then, of course, we were able to team up for Zahir. It was great.
Mm. Well, thank you for sharing your story. And Leslie, thank you so much for sharing the work of your husband, Bob Ginsburg, and the work that he did to help secure freedom for Abdullah Zahir. That is all the time that we have today. Again, our guests were David Slay, an attorney in St. Johnsbury. David, thank you so much for returning to the program.
My pleasure.
And Leslie Ginsburg, whose late husband worked with David on securing the release of a Guantanamo detainee. Leslie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.